This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on another Trumpet Hour Week in Review. I'm here at the Ed Stone Radio Studio in England. Our panel of trumpet writers are ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the Ed Stone Studio with me, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And back in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
So we're going to start with North Korea. It has conducted another long-range missile test, this one even more impressive than the one on July 4th. The headline in The Diplomat, July 29th, North Korea just tested a missile that could likely reach Washington, D.C. with a nuclear weapon. That's a pretty bold, pretty dramatic headline. The tension in this situation continues to ramp up. To learn more about this, we're going to go to Jeremiah.
Yes, the Korean Peninsula remains one of the tensest and most volatile places on the planet. And on July 28th, the government in North Korea there carried out its second test of the Hwasong-14 KN-20 intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM. And the frequency of these tests is increasing so quickly that it's becoming hard to keep track of all of them, really. But this was, as you said, a notable test. It was another milestone and indicates that North Korea's progress in its development of ICBMs is even further ahead than was evident on that July 4th test, which was when they tested the Hwasong-14 for the first time. This July 28th missile had an apogee, or a high point, of 2,300 miles, and it flew for 47 minutes, so both of those numbers are considerably greater than what we saw with the July 4th test, which was an apogee of 1,700 miles and a 37-minute flight time. And that suggests that back on July 4th, the North intentionally didn't test the Hwasong-14 to its full ability, which is what many had speculated at that time. But this apogee of the July 28th test places key U.S. cities like Chicago, New York, and Boston well within the missile's range. And as you said, experts believe that even Washington, D.C. is within its reach. And that's also another big difference between the July 4th test and this latest one, because back on the 4th, some people believe that it would only place Alaska and parts of Hawaii within range. So it is notable and it is alarming. It shows that nuclear North Korea is making rapid advances in its goal of operationalizing an ICBM that can range the U.S. mainland. And South Korea there across the border is really taking note of the North's reckless behavior and of the North's growing operational ability. Listeners may remember that we did a pretty lengthy Trumpet Hour segment back in May about South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, and the way he wanted to take a warmer approach to South Korea's relations with North Korea. President Moon even made the decision in June to suspend the expansion of America's Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile system. That's the system there in South Korea that is designed to prevent North Korea's missiles from hitting South Korea and Japan and elsewhere. And President Moon halted the deployment of that THAAD system after only two of its six launchers were in place. And President Moon thought that those kinds of moves and overtures might convince North Korea that they could be more friendly to South Korea. But yesterday, because of the July 4th test and the July 28th test, the South Korean Defense Ministry said, they basically said, never mind, we are going to go ahead and deploy the remaining four THAAD launchers. The threat in North Korea is too great. Our attempts at quelling their wrath with appeasement have failed. So we're now, you know, basically redoubling our defenses. We're cozying up to America even more to have more U.S. protection. So they are forging ahead with the full deployment of the THAAD system. And it's a pretty major development, in large part because of just how much that infuriates China. China, from the very beginning, has strongly condemned the THAAD system. And as of yesterday, China has now summoned South Korea's ambassador to China, just as to issue kind of a reproach to him. And China's now warning the South that their relations will suffer long-term damage. So the Korean crisis is really barreling ahead, and its geopolitical ramifications are affecting more and more countries.
Okay, you covered a lot of ground there. I want to just back up and talk first a little bit more about this missile launch specifically, because we had talked about this, Richard and I talked about this last week on the Wednesday program, just how much the American press in particular has kind of written this off, the July 4th test especially, as not really being of any grave concern. And one of the specific things that they said, well, we don't really need to worry about it, was because it was only, quote unquote, able to reach Alaska. So here we are just a few weeks later, and suddenly we've got pretty much most of the United States within range of this missile. So there's one of the major elements that was supposedly meant to put our minds at ease, that we didn't really have much to worry about being blown out of the sky, so to speak. What has the response been in the press to recognizing that there's so much larger of a threat? The diplomat is not necessarily we're not talking about a major news source. How much has this really been in mainstream reportage?
From what I've seen, it has made its way into the assessments of most any Korean analysts. They see that the July 4th test was intentionally, perhaps because they used a more heavily weighted dummy warhead on the July 4th test. It kept the apogee from being as high as this July 28th test. So there's still a lot of question about if there was an actual nuclear warhead that weighed as much as it, you know, would weigh, as to what the apogee would be, what the range would be. But from what I can tell, though, in light of this July 28th test, even the mainstream analysts now acknowledge that most of the U.S. is within range. As for whether or not Washington, D.C. is in range, that's still debated. But cities like Chicago and Boston, I don't think there's any question anymore.
At least in my reading of some of what the press or what some of these kind of like foreign policy think tanks and things like that are talking about, I haven't seen anyone really talking about the risk of a nuclear bomb hitting America. What they seem to be most worried about in terms of what they talk about is the risk of America going to war with North Korea. And it's almost like they just cannot even conceive of a North American city being hit by a nuclear weapon. So that's not even part of their calculations. Mm-hmm. And that it all just revolves around, well, is there a risk now that Donald Trump will irresponsibly take us to war with North Korea? That seems to be kind of the biggest concern that I've seen them articulating. And it reminds me of some of the things that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has said over maybe the last 5-10 years or so of just, you know, can we even get our minds to get to grips with the reality of nuclear war? And it's something that, if we're honest with world news, if we're honest with history, is going to happen. It's something, obviously, that we know from Bible prophecy that's going to happen. But it seems like so much just they can't even conceive of this. It's too destructive that they just have to find these smaller things to talk and write about instead.
Right. And in this case, here you have South Korea that's clearly responding to what it views as a legitimate threat out of North Korea as it sees these tests continuing. South Korea is basically saying we really are put in a position where we have no choice, even though it is going to put China on edge and put us in their sights. So China's response to South Korea really isn't unexpected, but the fact that South Korea is responding the way it is shows that it's taking the North Korean threat seriously.
Yes, yes. The South Koreans clearly take this North Korean threat and their rapid advance very seriously. And it's clear that as much as they would like to be on good terms with China, they're willing to sustain a lot of economic damage. There's already been a huge fallout in Chinese tourism to South Korea over the THAAD system. But the South Korean government there is willing to endure all of that because they feel that being able to defend themselves against this very viable threat is more important.
Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. We're going to move over to Europe, another terrorist attack in Germany. These are happening somewhat regularly in recent months. This one in Hamburg and at the hands of a Muslim refugee. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this would have happened right around when we were recording this program. Last week, there was a refugee. His name is, he's been named Ahmed Alhor, the press have reported. And he was at a local supermarket in Hamburg. He grabbed a knife off the shelf and began stabbing people. He killed one. He injured quite a few others until eventually he was overpowered, captured, and now he's now he's in police custody. But you've got yet another attack here. I mean, you see, it's all the same elements that we've seen from all of these attacks before. So he's arrested. And again, just as normal, the first few days after the attacks, the police scrupulously avoid talking about Islam, avoid talking about terrorism, don't use the terror word, this kind of thing. And then eventually kind of come around to, okay, yes, he was a terrorist. They kind of play down accounts of him saying Allah Akbar while he's stabbing people, that kind of thing. But then also he was a Palestinian. He came in as a refugee. Just like the attacker in December, he should have been deported, but he didn't have the right paperwork for being deported, so the deportation was delayed. Just like the December attacker, I believe, he was known to authorities already. He was on their radar as possible links to Islamism. And just like the December attack, it's just using everyday objects that are incredibly hard to stop. I mean, that was a truck. This was a knife that he didn't even own. He just grabbed it off the shelf in the supermarket. And now this particular supermarket in Hamburg has stopped selling knives. but that's not a sustainable solution to the whole crisis. And the only difference, say, maybe from this to the Hamburg attack, I mean, from the one in December, is that this then comes in the run-up to the German election. That election is in September 24th. As we get into August, we're getting into the heart of campaigning. And so, well, you would have thought then that this would put terrorism right at the heart of the campaign. It's probably put it in the heart of a lot of what people are concerned about. And so you can see now this being more of an election issue as well.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Because every time one of these attacks happens, even though you have this repetitively weak response on the part of the government, you still do have a surge in concern and anxiety among the German populace. And that's where you see results within, say, more local elections. And what we've been seeing within elections across Europe is European voters responding to anti-immigrant sentiment and parties that are rising that are basically promising to deal with this in a more forcible way. So really, it will be interesting to watch as we go forward how much this could affect this coming German election.
I think it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the rise of a lot of these new parties, where in Germany you don't necessarily have that. There's the alternative for Deutschland, but they're polling fairly low at the moment. It looks like they might squeak in. It looks like they're just about going to squeak in with about 5%, the minimum that's required for them to get into parliament, but certainly down from some of the highs that they were before. And so I think it can be tempting. Some people may want to say, well, okay, you know,
threat's over.
You know, they're embracing the mainstream. One of the other big trends from Germany over the last, well, month or so is there's a new book that's come out called Finnish Germania that has, it was number one on Amazon's bestseller list. It was shooting up Spiegel's bestseller list. In fact, it was selling 250 copies an hour. The publisher's now completely sold out of books. Meanwhile, the entirety of the German press was denouncing this book. Spiegel actually removed it from their bestsellers list so it wouldn't show up there because they didn't want to give this book any extra promotion. And it's one that's really arguing forcefully against the response that Germany's taken to the migrant crisis. It's arguing for Germany to be proud of its history. It's arguing really along similar lines to the AfD and some of these. There's a lot of really shocking sentiment in this book, basically arguing that the Holocaust isn't unique in terms of its evil, and Britain and America have done things comparatively bad. Germany's being unfairly victimized and demonized in a way that it shouldn't be. They're scapegoats, this kind of thing. And it's hugely popular. So even though, say, some of this fear of migrants and this kind of thing might not be filtering through to a massive vote for the AfD, there's still a huge number of Germans that are very sympathetic to this rhetoric, and that you can tell when something like this book just flies off the shelves, are very concerned here and want a, you know, they want Germany to stand up much more strongly against Islam, stand up for itself, and just have much more pride in Germany.
It's a very important situation to keep our eyes on. We have an article up on the website. It went up on Wednesday. It's called "Hamburg Terrorist Attack Follows Familiar Pattern" by Josue Michels, and he just draws attention to a point that we've been making repeatedly, just based on biblical prophecy, that we are going to see the rise of a strong man within Germany, and each terrorist attack makes that more likely. At some point, it is going to be reflected in a national vote, whether it happens in this election or a future one. You can see that groundswell of support for a candidate that really does provide decisive leadership, even if, and being more confrontational with Islam. So always important to keep our eyes on this trend and how this is unfolding within Germany in particular. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've been following the war going on in Yemen between the government and Houthi rebels, and showing you how this really has Iran's fingerprints all over it. For some time, outside nations have been working to prevent Iran from funneling material into the Houthis and supporting that cause. A new exclusive report by Reuters shows a way that Iran has been evading these international efforts. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it seems the Iranians are very desperate to get weapons into the hands of the Houthi rebels down there in Yemen. And they've got a lot of means at their disposal to do this, the latest of which, as you said, was uncovered by Reuters. And it was an exclusive report from them, which is reliable just because they have broken a lot of the Houthi-Iranian relationship. It seems like somebody at Reuters, one of their reporters, has a very good contact in Iran. They break a story, and then it's confirmed a couple of months later through other sources as well. That happened earlier this year. What they're doing right now, apparently, is using Kuwaiti waters, which obviously Kuwait is right by Iran. They are taking weaponry from Iran, transporting it onto small boats so they can evade a lot of the international shipping through there or the international shipping lane. Well, at least the smaller boats don't bring that much attention to the arms. And they, a lot of the time, the armaments part are dismantled, and they are given to the Kuwaiti flagged vessels and other vessels, and then they make their way down to the Houthis that way, instead of taking ships from Iran trying to get into Houthi territory in Western Yemen themselves. They're using an intermediary here, and it looks like it's been going on, at least according to Reuters, for the past 6 months.
So put this in context, just remind us of why Iran is so interested in this part of the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, so this is on the other side from Iran. Iran pretty much dominates the Strait of Hormuz, at least the northern part of the Strait of Hormuz, one of the choke points for international shipping from the Persian Gulf out to the Indian Ocean. And then if you want to get from the Indian Ocean into the Mediterranean, so if you want to get from anywhere from Asia up into Europe, which I think is something like $800 billion worth of trade between Europe and Asia each year, shipping through into the Mediterranean Sea from the Indian Ocean. You've got to go through the Suez Canal, but you also have to go through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is what borders Western Yemen. And Western Yemen right now, for the past year and a half, has been controlled by the Houthis ever since they took over the government. And we said, as soon as that happened, that this was Iran's work. Iran was at work arming this Shiite proxy, and they were the ones that were utilizing Iranian arms to try and control this shipping lane so that Iran has both control over the Persian Gulf and has the ability to jeopardize, maybe not shut completely right now, but at least jeopardize any shipping through into the Red Sea, which would then go up into travel, into the Mediterranean.
And the Houthis, we had talked initially about just how they were denying involvement with Iran, and over time they've kind of come out, and it's been more broadly understood that Iran really is behind this. Give us a sense of the scale and the scope of how much Iran is really even making the Houthi offensive possible, and how much this route that they're using here is contributing to that.
Right. Well, we don't know exactly how much this route itself has contributed, apart from the evidence that they are bringing missiles over into Yemen and giving them to the Houthis. The Houthis do not have the ability to make these weapons. We saw one. It was a Burkhan 2, I think. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago, that was fired from Yemen, that went all the way into past Mecca, past Medina, up into northern Saudi Arabia, traveling 930 kilometers. This was a Scud-type weapon. These are the type of weapons that Iran is shipping. They're dismantled, and then they are put back together once they arrive in Yemen. Yeah, and the Houthis don't have the ability to create these. Now, and this has been going on, again, I mean, we've talked about Iran sending weapons by ship into the port of Hodeidah. That's in western Yemen. And they have had four container loads of weapons arrive there that have been picked up, or at least traced by international vessels. And then you had the overland route that we talked about, how they shipped arms through Oman. And now we have another route going through Kuwait. So any way that is possible to get weapons to the Houthis, Iran does it. And even if the Houthis, again, they declare their they say that they're not fully controlled by Iran, they are playing Iran's game. They're using Iran's weapons. They're using Iran's cash. Cash has been flowing into Yemen through this Kuwaiti route as well, apparently, according to the report. And that cash is coming from Iran. So obviously, Iran has interest in this. That is the point here. Whether the Houthis want to follow Iran or not, Iran's funneling money and weapons into this to serve their own interests.
Well, we appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story here before we take a quick break. Pope Francis has been fairly open in his criticism of U.S. President Donald Trump for a number of reasons. Well, this week, two people close to the Pope made a very strong accusation against American Catholics who support President Trump. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, watching the politics of religious demographics in the United States is always fairly fascinating. I mean, and there's a few givens that we know that generally, like secularist, atheist, agnostics generally vote Democrat, and evangelical Protestants generally vote Republican. But the Catholic vote has historically been pretty well evenly divided between the two. As a matter of fact, if you can predict which way the Catholics are going to vote in an election, you've got about an 80% chance of being able to predict the election in general. But this year, the divide's been a little more heated, with about half the Catholic, American Catholics, especially those in the Midwest, voting for Donald Trump and the Republican Party because of his campaign pledges to support pro-life legislation and to support religious freedom, with the other half of the Catholic Church supporting the Democratic candidate because of their pledges to do more income redistribution and to fight climate change and to make immigration into the United States easier. And like I said, this tension's been much higher than it's been in past years, with now, as you mentioned, two people very close to the Pope, publishers of a Jesuit magazine, La Civiltà Cattolica, coming out and saying that these conservative Catholics, they've formed like an alliance or an ecumenicalism of hate with U.S. evangelicals. And as you go through that article, it's talking about, it's just said these these Trump-supporting Catholics. He says they're opposed to fighting climate change. They're opposed to immigration. They want to build a wall on the border. And that pretty makes them no different from or not too far apart is the quote they use from Islamic jihadist. And so, as I mentioned, yes, it is
definitely pretty strong accusation.
Yeah, it's definitely strong accusation with this divide within the U.S. Catholic Church between those who are almost making common cause with the evangelical movement to support Donald Trump, and those who are almost about as anti-Trump as you can get.
Where do you think this is leading? What is this story really about? Is this demonstrating really personal animus between this particular pope and this particular president? Is it emblematic of a larger divide between the Vatican and the United States, or European Catholics versus American Catholics?
Both, actually. I think there is definitely a fairly high level of like personal animosity between the Trump administration and Pope Francis's those close to him in the Catholic Church. But this is also something that's been building for longer than that. They had one prominent Vatican watcher, professor at Villanova University, come out, and he said that it has really been shown that American Catholicism is diverging from European Catholicism and even Latin American Catholicism, and taking a much more, in his words, it said it's fallen into the hands of the religious right. And even in Europe, there is some divide between the what you call like the conservative and the progressive wings of the Catholic Church. But in Europe, that's more of an internal dispute over divorce and remarriage. To where in the United States, the divide is much deeper, going into issues like climate change and like income redistribution and big political topics like that, where at least half of the American Catholic Church is kind of taking a different standpoint from most of the rest of the Catholic world, which is what really makes this really significant, as you see that you've got this this huge voting demographic of conservative American Catholics that are more supportive of Donald Trump right now than they are the Vatican.
Well, I actually think I don't see how they become more ingratiated with the Vatican when they have somebody telling them that their political views basically put them in the same camp as Islamist terrorists. That's a pretty remarkable claim for these journalists that you're talking about and these priests to be making against American Catholics.
Right, and the Pope himself has had to been a little more careful in the words he uses, but definitely this this journal, which is a Vatican published journal, and they do have Vatican editors that go through it before it's published. So I mean, the Francis administration could have stopped the publication if they'd chosen to do so. But I think from a prophetic standpoint, it is starting to realize that maybe some of these issues over divorce and remarriage, the Catholic Church is going to have to do some compromise on in Europe. But some of these bigger things over climate change and immigration and building a wall, I do think they're within the walls of the Vatican. There's starting to be some realization that this is not going to be a divide that's going to be resolved peacefully. This is going to be something that's going to be a little bit more confrontational. And like I said, comparing them to Islamic jihadist is about as confrontational rhetoric as it gets.
Right. Well, thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about moves by the European Union into the Middle East and North Africa. Talk that it could actually replace the United States mediating the Arab-Jew conflict. Another strong authoritarian move by China, this time in Tibet. And why is the New York Times trying to rehabilitate communism? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
If you're using biblical prophecy as your guide to news watching, you have to keep a close eye on the European Union's activities in North Africa and the Middle East. And our next two stories focus on this, starting with Europe's response to the recent violence in Jerusalem. European officials have been expressing concern that this situation could blow up into a full-blown intifada. To learn more about this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, I'm glad you introduced the story this way, because otherwise you wouldn't think that this story is that important. What came out this week in a piece in Al Monitor was that the Europeans, especially the High Commissioner for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini, she is very concerned about what's going on right now regarding the Temple Mount crisis in Jerusalem, and the fact that she still believes that this has the potential to really deteriorate the situation as far as Israel and the Palestinians go. And she's really concerned about the fact that the United States isn't acting, or as far as she's concerned, isn't doing anything that could stabilize the situation. So apparently she's been talking very closely with France and Germany about an independent foreign policy different from the United States when it comes to the Palestinians and the Israeli peace process. And this is something we've watched for years, for the Europe and Germany to get more involved in the peace process at the expense of the United States. And it seems that they are having some very intimate discussions that it's almost time to break from the United States and pursue their own interests here.
Al Monitor, that's an interesting source for this information to appear. What details did we learn from it?
Well, another couple of details from it was the fact that the EU, with Germany and France at the lead right now, with Mogherini, they are going to wait at least past the September 2017 UN General Assembly meeting before they take any concrete steps or come out with their plan. They are also going to wait after the September 24th German election to see who gets in power. This is kind of contingent, according to our monitor, upon Merkel staying in power, or at least her government staying in power. And if the United States doesn't do anything that Europe likes as vis-a-vis the peace process over the next 2 months, then we'll see some dramatic changes as far as Europe's independence here.
So this move by the EU, or these intimations that they want to get more involved in this happens at the same time we actually have a report in the Jerusalem Post talking about Jared Kushner, who has been involved in diplomatic efforts with the Israelis and the Palestinians. The United States is basically... what is he telling the Jerusalem Post, and how does this impact what's happening with Europe?
Well, the Jerusalem Post reported on this, and it was actually a leak, another leak from the White House, which was Kushner talking about what his personal thoughts basically on the peace process. He is one of two individuals, Jason Greenblatt being the other, that President Trump has said that you are our agents basically to try and broker peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, this ultimate deal. Kushner heads that up. He is a Jew. He is the son-in-law, of course, of Mr. Trump. And he was caught in this leak saying that there might not be a solution to the peace process, which doesn't sound too positive. He also tended to focus on side with the Israelis instead of the Palestinians. So the Palestinians didn't really like that. And then you also have, at the same time, I think it was just past this week, at least through the United States Senate Committee, Foreign Relations Committee, there was the hearing about the Taylor Force law. Taylor Force was a young American that was killed here in Israel, I think it was last year, by a terrorist. And what happens to terrorists in Israel when they perpetrate a crime and go into an Israeli prison is that they are paid. There's a pay for slay program where they're paid a substantial amount from the Palestinian Authority. Both the terrorist and their families are paid. And this act right now that is about to go before the Senate itself for a vote, which looks like it will pass, says to the Palestinian Authority, well, you are not going to get any funding from the United States unless you renounce this policy and you stop paying terrorist families money determined by how many people they kill. basically, if you kill a lot of people, you get more money. And the United States says, if you keep this up, we're not getting you any money. So the United States right now is falling out of favor with the Palestinians. You've got Kushner that the Palestinians don't trust. And now apparently both sides, Democrats, this was bipartisan approval on the Foreign Relations Committee, said, yeah, we're standing up for this law. This is wrong. They shouldn't be paying terrorists by virtue of how many people they kill. But the U.S., they give a huge budget to the Palestinian Authority. And maybe this is just another nail in the coffin for U.S. brokered efforts. They're not showing themselves, according to the Palestinians, an honest broker. This may open the door as well for Europe.
Very interesting to watch. We appreciate that, Brent. The migrant crisis in Europe is an ongoing problem. This week, Europe began taking more robust measures to confront the problem. Two specific developments this week. Germany's defense minister was in Niger, and the Libyan government, based in Tripoli, invited Italian warships to come into its territorial waters to help stop this problem. To learn more about this and to put it in its larger context for us, we're going to go back to Richard Palmer.
That's right. So we've got these two developments that show Europe getting more involved in North Africa. The German one is perhaps more longstanding. For Germany, this is kind of more of a longstanding crisis. It's something that they need to solve, but it's not necessarily got this massive immediacy to it. They don't want migrants to keep coming through. So they're looking at Niger. They've also been looking at Mali, and we've talked before about that, heavily invested in Mali. That's one of their largest military deployments. They're leading EU missions to train the police. They're leading EU missions to train the army. They've got hundreds involved in the UN's deadliest wet mission in the world there in Mali. So that's one place where they're building up a base there to try and kind of stop the flow further upriver, if you like, before they even get to the North African coast. And then Niger is another one of these. 90% of all migrants from West Africa travel through Niger. It's a huge transit point. So what they're doing here, rather than German deployments, is building strong relationships with the Niger government. So they're helping them militarily. They gave them a whole load of trucks and motorcycles and satellite phones and they're working to help them on border, on terrorism, on cross-border crime, this kind of thing. They're also working with France to put together a new military force that's called G5 Sahel. This has been going on for some time, but it's basically to try to put together an armed force. You know, a lot of these migrants, it's all crossing borders. And so they're trying to put together a multinational force that can also cross borders to deal with this problem. And so this contains troops from Mali, Mauritania, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Chad. And France and Germany are giving them financial aid and helping to build kind of their own local army in this area. So that's Germany, what Germany's looking at. Italy is much more desperate, and they're looking much further upstream. They've got nearly 100,000 refugees have landed in Italy already just this year. Their asylum facilities are almost literally overflowing. They're desperate for help from the rest of Europe. The rest of Europe is not giving it. You know, Poland and some of Eastern Europe, they get a lot of flack for not accepting migrants. Even France, that's talking so much about European solidarity right now, is refusing to accept migrants from Italy. So they've come up with this deal with part of the Libyan government, where they're going to send patrol vessels into the Libyan coast. And this is a huge deal for Italy, because under the way that Europe interprets international law, if they pick up migrants within Libyan water, they can take them back to Libya. If they pick up migrants outside Libyan water, they have to take them home to Italy. And so if they can pick them up within that 12 miles of the Libyan coast, well, that's a huge bonus for them. They're doing that at the same time they're cracking down on non-governmental organizations, NGOs, to try and stop them from picking up migrants, which, I mean, I guess if you're cynical, means that more migrants are going to drown and fewer migrants are going to reach Italy, which is a way of dealing with the problem. And to be fair to Italy, they take the long-term view, which is probably correct, that these NGOs, by making it easier for migrants to get to Italy, are encouraging more people to make this risky journey with criminals and gangs, and therefore are, in the long run, increasing the death toll. And I think they're probably right in making that argument. Mm-hmm. So they're cracking down on that. So you're seeing a few different approaches here. I think, you know, Italy's is more immediate. It's important to notice, though, with Italy that this is not universally popular in Libya, their decision to put troops there with the Navy. You know, Libya used to be Italy's colonial possession. They're not at all keen on going back to being a colonial possession. So there are people there that fiercely guard their independence. General Khalifa Haftar, hugely influential in Italy. He said that he would attack Italian, or hugely influential in Libya. He said he would even attack the Italian boats himself. I don't think he has the capacity to do that, but it shows the hostility there from whole segments of Libya. And despite this kind of French agreement that we talked about in the lightning round last week, that between some of these different groups, there's still a huge amount of division in Italy. And there are a lot of people saying this French agreement isn't even worth the piece of paper that it's written on. So, yes, Italy's trying to get more involved in Libya, but you can kind of see the seeds of how that might not go very well, and how it could even backfire and push Libyans to backing Islamist alternatives to Libya getting more involved.
Yeah, Brent, very quickly.
Yeah, well, I think it's just really interesting that once this got approved from the Italian parliament, it didn't take long at all, just a number of hours, and then you had ships basically starting to go into Libyan waters. And it had to come at a request from the UN-backed government there, which apparently there was a lot of disagreement upon the leader saying of the Libyan-backed Libyan government saying, no, I didn't put this request in. The Italian said I did, but I didn't. And then the foreign minister of the Libyan leader said, yes, my leader did. So it just shows that back and forth shows how volatile the situation is for the public inside Libya. As Richard was saying, there has already been riots and protests on the streets in Tripoli, where the UN-backed government rules from, against this act, because they see it as Europe's step into their sovereign territorial waters. And as he said, Libyans have a history with the Italians down there, and they are even glorifying a lot of the Libyan leaders from the 20s and 30s that were trying to get rid of the Italians. They've got big posters of them on the walls and in their protests, carrying the posters of this man that led the Italians to get booted out of Libya. So this isn't a situation which the Libyans are welcoming the Italians there with open arms, but it does show as well Italy needs to be there. And I think Italy and Germany as well, they'll be happy that they've finally got a foot in the door here.
Thanks for that, gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, a Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. China's moves toward stronger authoritarianism continue. This week it made a power play in Tibet, a supposedly autonomous region of China. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Chinese government is demolishing hundreds of homes and evicting thousands of people from Tibet's city in the sky. This city is officially called Larungar. It's at the east end of the vast Tibetan plateau, and it's home to the world's largest Tibetan Buddhist institute. And since the city is at an altitude of about 13,000 feet, it has earned the nickname City in the Sky. And in recent years, it's been home to somewhere between 10,000 and 40,000 people. But a little over a year ago, the government of Beijing said the city in the sky is overcrowded and that the population has to be reduced to a maximum of 5,000 people by October of 2017. So ever since then, government work teams have been busy tearing down lots of homes and cabins and corralling thousands of people into trains and relocating them to other parts of China. A total of 1,500 homes and cabins have been destroyed so far, and almost all of these were nuns' and monks' residences. And a total of 3,730 people so far have been made to leave the area. So the government says that this mass relocation is because of concerns about overpopulation, but it's clearly a crackdown on religious freedom. That's obvious from the way the monks and the nuns were targeted. China really sees Tibetan religion, as it sees most any religion, as kind of a threat to the power of the Communist Party. And so this is also an instance of the Chinese government just decimating one of the main icons of Tibetan culture. And the indications are that the government is doing this so that it can make this very remote and iconic city in the sky a popular tourist destination. So it's apparently clearing room for more hotels and things like that. We don't hear very much about it anymore, but Tibetans have been campaigning for freedom and for sovereignty ever since the early 1950s when Chinese forces started occupying their nation. The people there are racially, they're quite different from the ethnic Han who comprise the majority of the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, they never wanted to be a part of China. But now, after some 67 years of occupation, and despite all kinds of attempts at resistance, Tibet is very much assimilated into China, and the Chinese government is taking some really heavy-handed and, you know, iron-fisted actions to get its way there. So it's a pretty sobering development, I think.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll move on. The New York Times has been printing a series of articles called Red Century. It is dedicated to, quote, exploring the history and legacy of communism 100 years after the Russian Revolution. Quite favorable to the communist revolution. Why would the New York Times be doing this? I doubt he can answer that question satisfactorily, but nevertheless, for this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, I've been following this Red Century series for a couple months now. Like I said, they've been doing this all year, and they've got over a dozen articles up there by now. And it is just really surprising the angle they've taken, because you normally think, okay, well, 100 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, this is kind of going to see is like, okay, well, now that we're 100 years into this socialist experiment, what's it been like? And the one article I read, it says it's called The Unexpected Afterlife of American Communism. And I mean, it's pointing out how some of the ideas that like Senator Bernie Sanders is bringing forward is resurrecting communist ideas in the United States. And then it takes a look back at the history of communism in the United States. But it's all about the Communist Party's USA's fight for worker rights in the 1930s and their fight against priest brutality and their fight against for racial minority rights and for civil rights. And it, you could almost be forgiven after reading through it that the Communist Party USA was one of the best things to ever happen to the United States. if you didn't have any other source material to go by. But they did another one, too, called Socialism's Future, Maybe It's Past, talking about how we need a return to the socialist values of the earliest 20th century. And this one actually does mention that, like, okay, well, some things did go wrong in Soviet Russia. So I'm grateful that the New York Times recognizes that fact. but their main point, as they said, but it only went wrong because it was too authoritarian. He said, we need to go back to the principles of socialism, but a socialism where like a democratic socialism where the people get to vote instead of a dictator deciding.
Right. Yeah. Well, hasn't that kind of always been the promise of socialism, that that it is in the interest of the people, but it's always has to be implemented with authoritarian measures?
Right. Well, and for a series of articles on history, it's fairly light on history in that there's been only a handful, probably less than a handful, of communist revolutions that started out as like an authoritarian coup. Most of them, I mean, with the Mensheviks in Russia, or Fidel Castro's promise to have free and fair elections, or even what's happening in Venezuela now, have started out with people voting. And even in the worst days of the Soviet Union, people still did vote in elections. You could only vote for the Communist Party, and oftentimes there was only one communist candidate on the ticket to vote for, but you could cast a ballot if you felt like it. And so that's... I think Ronald Reagan kind of summarized the problem with that best is when he said that any government so powerful to give you anything you want is also powerful enough to take away everything you have. And that's really what the socialist idea has run up for over this past red century, is that every time the people vote in officials with the authority to redistribute income and nationalize industries and be able to give them anything they want to vote for, they don't realize is that government is now so powerful that they can take away whatever you have. You've passed a tipping point that you can vote for Fidel Castro and he can promise free and fair elections. But by the time you've given him almost totalitarian powers to redistribute wealth to the poor, he may decide later on that he doesn't care for the poor all that much. And it's, you're just really kind of at his mercy if he's got the troops to back up his will.
Right. Well, you have to wonder how many times communism has to fail, how many different countries it has to prove not a viable system before the folks at the New York Times would accept the verdict of history.
Right. Well, I've got dozens of revolutions over a full 100 years on the record now, but apparently we need to try it one more time in America before the New York Times will pass final verdict.
Well, thank you, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. The stories that we talk about on the program, we try to put as many of them up on the website as possible. You can read more about what we've been talking about here online or on this program. We're going to finish with our lightning round of important news coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this past week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Jeremiah.
If your summer travel plans included North Korea, you may have to make some changes, because on Wednesday, the U.S. State Department made its travel ban to the North official. The restriction will be enforced beginning on September 1st, and all U.S. passport holders are instructed to be out of North Korea by that time. Tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have risen for months, and this travel ban is just the latest of many indications showing that a serious conflict could be on the horizon.
Dennis Rodman will have to go somewhere else. We'll go now to Brent.
Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh on Wednesday gave his first speech since being elected to replace Khalid Mashal as the head of the movement. He did give some main goals of Hamas, but then he also denied in this speech Israel's right to the Western Wall, saying, quote, it's an inherent part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and cannot be abandoned. And then he also thanked Iran for its unlimited support for the Al-Qassam Brigades, which is the violent wing of Hamas, and its contribution to the development of Hamas's military capabilities.
All right, over to Andrew.
Last week, the number of murders in Baltimore surpassed 200, making 2017 a record-setting year for violence in the city. Baltimore, Maryland is now well on track to be the most violent city in the United States and one of the 20 most violent cities in the world. As the body count rises, police departments have reassigned 150 officers to the city's most dangerous regions, but it's still struggling to curb the internal turmoil.
All right, over to Richard.
Germany and France have been discussing increasing cooperation within a small core group of Eurozone nations, the German newspaper Handelsblatt reported this week. It said that, quoting insiders within the French government, they said that they're already doing this when it comes to defense, but France wants to move this forward when it comes to the economy as well. They also pointed to some statements that Emmanuel Macron said in the run-up to the election. For example, he said that if our ambition to act together is not shared in with the whole community, we have to find ways of moving faster in a smaller group. And they said that after the German election, you could see concrete plans to have a smaller group of nations within the Eurozone move forwards towards basically a superstate. They could be published within the next few months.
All right, over to Jeremiah.
As China keeps on tightening its grip on the free flow of information, especially on the internet, the American tech giant Apple seems to be kowtowing to the Chinese Communist Party. On July 29th, at least 60 different VPN providers announced that Apple had suddenly removed their apps from the China App Store. VPNs, or virtual private networks, basically reroute web traffic through servers in another country. So if you're using the internet in China and you want to bypass the Great Firewall of China, you can access, so that you can access the vast number of websites that the government blocks, you have to use a VPN to do it. But now China is cracking down on them, and it looks like Apple is bending the knee to help the Chinese government in this alarming crackdown.
All right, back to Brent.
This is out of my region, but I thought it was an important story. A local council in Australia has banned the construction of a synagogue in Bondi because it could become a terrorist target. The Land and Environment Court backed the decision by the Waverley Council to prohibit the construction of a synagogue in Wellington Street, Bondi, which is one of Australia's most famous beaches. Rabbi Yehoram Ullman, the head of the local Jewish community, said that the decision is unprecedented. Its implications are enormous. It basically implies that no Jewish organization should be allowed to exist in residential areas. It stands to stifle Jewish existence and activity in Sydney, and indeed, by creating a precedent, the whole of Australia, and by extension, rewards terrorism.
Back to Andrew.
The White House's frustration with information leaks is growing, and the Trump administration is stepping up efforts to crack down on it. Both the Attorney General and the National Intelligence Director discussed measures today concerning leaks of classified information threatening national security. One presidential advisor is even raising the possibility of using lie detectors for the small number of people working in the White House West Wing. These discussions come in the wake of a scandal where the Washington Post published confidential transcripts of President Trump's phone conversation with the leaders of Mexico and Australia.
Right. Back to Richard.
Romania announced that it was going to boost its defense spending by about $10 billion. They promised that for the next decade, they are going to meet NATO's minimum spending of 2% of GDP, making them only the sixth NATO member to do that out of nearly 30 NATO members. So a significant step up there, showing their commitment to military. You also saw recently the Czech Republic announced that they would increase their spending from 1.1% of their GDP to 1.4% by 2020, still aiming to boost that further later. And then a final piece of military news from Europe, Sweden and Germany signed a letter of intent for the two nations to work together much more with their military, especially over the sea in the Baltic and also with their air force.
All right, we'll finish with Jeremiah.
In China, there is a solar panel farm nearing completion that is shaped like a massive panda bear. The farm is being constructed in Datong in Shanxi province by a company called Panda Green Energy. And the power plant has about 1,500 acres of solar panels, and hundreds of those are arranged in the shape of China's national treasure and most popular animal, the panda bear. The first stage of the plant's already on the power grid and producing clean energy. And by the time the project is finished, it's estimated that it will produce 100 megawatts of energy at one time.
That's a nice way to finish. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on today's program. You can give us feedback by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Thanks to this distinguished panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be
Thank
here.
You.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of PJ O'Rourke. Everybody wants to save the earth. Nobody wants to help mom do the dishes. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.